Yeah, there it is. When that robot voice pops in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
ELB.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks in sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're just out for an evening stroll. Maybe you're stuck in traffic listening to us in your car. Maybe you're taking the kids to school because it's back to school already in most of America. Whatever the case, we're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. They bring the show to you. Their generosity, their support, their belief in what we do here means we get to keep making these episodes. And in exchange, they get some cool stuff, bonus perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and bonus content. Oh, so much bonus content, ladies and gentlemen, including Feeling This Fridays, where the feeling this show is coming out, making you feel good for the weekend. Christian Spicer, Alex Solman talking about the feelings behind video games. Oh, it's so good. A whole first season, second season rocking right now. Plus, the DLC Book Club audio-only version, the podcast version where Lana Bashinsky and I talk about the Malazan Books of the Fallen. We're starting on book 3, Memories of Ice. So much fun. We had our interview with Steven Erickson. So much fun. Plus, you got your paid DLC program on Wednesdays. That's your hump day. Get you through the week. Little jolt in the arm of Goofy, because we get a little wacky there. On the Wednesday show, paid DLC, where Christian Spicer and Lana Bashinsky and myself just talking about whatever comes up. It's good times, and it's all for patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games and their many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, this spelled with two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host, slash nemesis. He's the blue slash purple slash orange slash red Ninja Turtle. It's Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everyone. Real quick up top, and unfortunately we can do this far too often, but having visited Hawaii for the first time myself this past year, the folks in Maui really suffered an incredible tragedy. Again, it's going on around the world, unfortunately, and we try not to mention it every week. But having just visited Maui for the first time myself recently and having made some charitable donations, I would encourage listeners to check out how they can help those folks there suffering right now in one of the state's worst natural disasters and certainly one of the worst fire casualties in the United States in a long time. And so if you have a little bit to spare and you can help those folks out, a little bit from a lot of people can go a very long way. And I would encourage our listeners to, put some good into the world.
Very good note. I mean, it is so sad to see what is going on there. Somebody who, right before COVID, last trip I ever took before COVID was to Maui and went to those exact beaches and stayed at a lot of the places that have been wiped out. Very sad to see. I don't know if you have a specific place to send folks, but
Nowhere specific. I mean, there are a few that I could reference, but I also don't want to point people somewhere that, you know, they think that their money can do better somewhere else. But there are great relief efforts happening right now. And I encourage folks to take a little bit of time and see where they think their money can go the furthest.
Indeed. Always hard to pivot from that to video games, but we do have a lot of stuff to talk about. I know Christian likes to surprise me with these things, but there's a lot of stuff to talk about video game wise. And ladies and gentlemen, we have one of our favorite guests to do it with. You know that DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, oh, I'm so excited because DLC stands for Digital Livelihoods and Commerce, because we have the co-host of the Virtual Economy podcast, as well as the author of the Game Dev Business Handbook. It's our friend Mike Futter back with us. Hey, Mike.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back.
Love having you on the show. Love to dig into some interesting news. We're kind of in that percolating right before Gamescom period, but there's still some interesting stuff going on. Certainly lots of huge games out to talk about. So let's get right into it and start the show the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also send comments or questions, anything you'd like us to know. We love hearing from you. dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But that's not the only way. You can also check out our subreddit, which is 5x5dlc.reddit.com. Or our Discord, which is 5x5DLC on Discord. Lots of great folks hanging out, talking about the show, talking about video games and all sorts of other stuff. Really cool community. I urge you to take part. But Mike, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
We were just talking about this before the show, but that Overwatch 2 story, hitting Steam and then tanking hard. I think that we're getting a look at the fallout from the divorce, I guess, between Blizzard and it was NetEase, right?
Yeah, NetEase. Hard to see mom and dad partner fight, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, mom and dad didn't just fight. NetEase took sledgehammers to that Warcraft statue that was out in front of their office. They were
they Adam Driver'd the wall, you might say.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Mike is referring to the fact that Overwatch 2 has debuted on Steam. Not a lot of Blizzard games on Steam, but Overwatch 2 came to Steam and has taken the dubious title of worst reviewed Steam game of all time. There is a website that tracks these things. It is called steam250.com, and you can go to their bottom 100 hall of shame, and you'll see Overwatch 2 there right at number one, right at the top of the list of worst reviewed games on Steam. It has a score, an average score of 0.96. That's with 92,000 votes.
I mean, it is broken, terrible animations. It's way too expensive. You know, like, it just doesn't work. It's like a new IP that they just made. No, I'm just kidding. It's none of those things.
Well, I think
it's none of those things.
Certainly a case to be made that it is an odd sequel in that it switched to the free-to-play model, and it did a lot of things that I think have frustrated folks. But right before we started recording, Mike pointed us to this really interesting write-up from Daniel Ahmad, who is Director of Research and Insights at Nico Partners, game industry analyst. You want to summarize what his point of view is, Mike? Because I think it's an interesting take that I wasn't aware of when I first saw this story.
I mean, first of all, Dan is one of the smartest people I know. I've known him for a number of years before even he was at Nico Partners, and I've always really appreciated his perspective on the industry and especially on China and Asia. And that's kind of where this is grounded. If you look at the reviews, what you're seeing is people in China who were really upset that their Blizzard accounts, that their accounts with all of these games, because Blizzard and NetEase had a long-term partnership, and then it ended. I believe it was earlier this year, might have been late last year. And what happened was people had to abandon all of their progress and start over. So Overwatch 2 is playable in China. It is localized in Chinese on Steam, but it is not the same accounts that people were using before. They're really, really unhappy. There's no national server. Obviously the existing game accounts and the progress related to that didn't carry over. Logins are apparently slow. Online connections are very slow from China. It's just people are really, really unhappy in China. So this is largely being tanked by the Chinese market, who finally has an outlet to express their dissatisfaction with how that whole thing fell apart and left them out in the cold after years and years and years. What we've even got here, and Dan points out, if you wanted to follow him on Twitter, it's at Zhuge EX, so ZHUGEEX. I'm not calling it X.com. I refuse. Still Twitter.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So, what ended up happening here is there was a game that was previously the worst. And I see if you look at the Steam 250 list, it's number two right now, called War of the Three Kingdoms. It's a card battle game from a developer in China called Yuka. And people are so intent on making Overwatch 2 the worst reviewed game on Steam that they are going and leaving positive reviews on this other game, which is apparently legitimately bad, just to keep Overwatch 2 at the top of the hall of shame. It's really bad.
Never underestimate gamers' ability to min-max. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So just some statistics here from Daniel's account, which I think are pretty interesting. So nearly 100,000 views on Overwatch 2 on Steam since launching 3 days ago, as of his writing. He said 91% are negative. Of the 91% negative, two-thirds of those reviews, 63,000, are written in Chinese.
Simplified Chinese.
And 97% of those that are written in simplified Chinese are negative. So it is just the vast majority of what has lowered the average rating is what's going on here, which I don't think makes that an illegitimate score per mm-hmm. se. It does, you know, it does describe the reason why it's happening. And I'm curious what you think of that in general. Do you think this is problematic for Overwatch 2? Do you think it's merely a fun anecdote that isn't actually going to affect most people's reaction to the game? Or do you think it's something bigger than that?
I think that because it's Overwatch 2, I think it escapes that whole what is the Steam review score. I think user reviews on Steam are really important. I think looking at – I love the way Steam does this, all time and recent, because it allows you to see changes in the game. I think that that's really smart. I think that they're also now flagging when review bombing happens. So that is useful, unlike Metacritic, where when users come in and tank the reviews on the user side, there's not a whole lot of context to it. But this is also not just about the NetEase relationship falling apart. It's about the things that are happening globally with Overwatch 2, where people are still really unhappy about this strong pivot from PvP to a promise of significant PvE to walking that back and then releasing the first set of missions for $15. And if you look at the Western reviews for those, you can even see people saying, hey, this is interesting, but it's not $15 worth of content. This does not meet the value bar that we expect. And it certainly doesn't when you're talking about Blizzard.
Yeah.
And on top of it, you've got Blizzard, who is still stumbling through Diablo 4 right now. Not as badly as they did through the launch of Diablo 3. But things aren't clicking at Blizzard right now. And it's very noticeable. And a lot of that is very likely brain drain due to all of the problems that Activision Blizzard has had.
Oh, sure.
And Blizzard specifically.
Yeah, it seems like every other newly formed developer studio is former Blizzard. It does seem like there was a bit of an exodus that has resulted in a bunch of new studios forming. So, yeah, I think that's a pretty solid analysis. Christian, Overwatch 2, number one. Then we've got War of the Three Kingdoms, Flat Out 3, Chaos and Destruction, Identity, Uriel's Chasm, Space Base DF9, O2 Jam Online, Mobile Suit Gundam Battle Operation 2, Roller Coaster Tycoon World, and Goddess are your top 10 worst ranked games. As I would have expected, I've never heard of most of those, you know, because you figure there's a lot of shovelware, a lot of garbage that people will rightly flag as being pretty bad. So I would assume a lot of these are just real bad games. But it's also interesting looking on this list. There are some pretty big games that pop up. Redfall this year came out May, hits the list at 17, worst reviewed. That's pretty intense. Call of Duty Warzone is at 23 from November. And Modern Warfare 2 is at 29, Dynasty Warriors 9, Deus Ex The Fall. There's some. Resident Evil Reverse. There's some bigger games on here that clearly Resident Evil Resistance at 39. There's some clearly some games that, you know, people were just angry and galvanized around bad reviews. And I think that's the case here with Overwatch 2. And obviously we've touched on the, you know, the Chinese issue. What is your take on how big of a problem this is, or what it represents for what is a giant franchise for Blizzard and a big IP?
I don't think it's that big of a problem for Blizzard. The being the worst reviewed game on Steam of all time, that in isolation, I don't think is that big of a problem for Blizzard. I think, as Mike pointed out, it is enough of a known quantity, and it's coming to Steam after not being on Steam for a while. Like, it established itself. People know what that game is. I think the larger issue is Activision Blizzard's relationships with China and that huge gaming audience, and how do you bridge that divide in a way that is satisfactory to everyone and also plays by the rules required in order to have a game release in those territories. And I think, like many things, unfortunately, the people left to suffer, there are worse things in the world, but the people left out are the gamers, the people who want to be playing these games and aren't given an opportunity because of, you know, powers higher and bigger than them fighting and wrestling over where a comma is amongst a lot of zeros. So I don't think it's that big of an issue for them in terms of the review itself. I think the bigger issue outside of the Activision Blizzard and Chinese relations is the internet. I don't know what the internet is right now, or even social media. I don't know if it's a teenager at this point, or if it's a Gen Xer, you know, like what generation the internet and social media is at right now in terms of growing up. But I think we're seeing a lot of growing pains in that space with Twitter and X, or what Threads is, or people's approach to social media in general, or sharing. I mean, there was a time, I feel like, where if you went out and you took up every picture on your phone was posted on your Facebook account or on your MySpace account. Like, you went out, you took 20 pictures, they were all posted, bad ones, good ones. It's like, this is what we did. And we journaled everything, right? And that has changed, or is changing. And I think user reviews are also in that space of, like, there was a time where it was like, everyone will have a voice and you won't just be stuck listening to what so-and-so food critic thinks of this hole-in-the-wall restaurant that is a local favorite, but of course it's not like a five-course meal, so whatever fancy newspaper food critic is like, oh, it's not that great, but everybody loves it because now everybody has a voice. Democratization of opinions is incredible. And now we've seen over time that, like, you know, Yelp's not that great. User reviews for movies aren't that great in a lot of ways, and for video games aren't that great. But I think Mike made a great point in saying that as a consumer, there's very little outlet or valve to voice your frustration at something that is largely out of your control. And I think we're seeing people use review scores for that, user scores for that, then mixed with the internet memeing and dunking. So I feel like I would guess, and I don't have this data, but I would guess that a lot of the positive scores for the prior worst game are people just getting in on the meme, you know, taking it to the moon or whatever. And I don't have an answer for it, Jeff. Mike, I don't know if you do, but I understand it, but it's frustrating and problematic. And I think, to me, that's the bigger issue, is the democratization of everything. Apparently we all suck.
we do, but I also worry about the fall of Twitter as the town square, because if you look at how brands used it, and I'm coming at this from the business side, that it is an important vehicle for brands to communicate with people, but also to take feedback. And yeah, there's a lot of crap in there. And we've seen the harassment, we've seen all of the bad stuff. And I think because there is so much bad stuff, we lose the good. And one of the things that I have seen since Musk took over Twitter, and the amount of discourse, like positive discourse there, has diminished even further, is that you no longer have that pipeline. And I wonder if that's by intent. I wonder if it's because Twitter was a way for the average person to speak truth to power, if they're using it the right way. There's the harassment angle and there's all of the bad stuff. And Twitter's trust and safety team was not great, but it was something. Now we have X and Blue Sky, and we know Facebook's trust and safety team is overworked and there's horror stories there. But I actually lament the loss of the best version of Twitter as the town square, because it has, I think, removed a outlet for people to legitimately and positively and constructively share their thoughts in a way that can actually be heard.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I want to pose this question kind of around this, because there are, from my perspective, there are multiple different lenses. What is the most important aspect of the way a game is received? Is it the gameplay? Is it the context, which is what we have here? We have context that's dragging this review score down. Or is it something else? Because you can have an empirically, and it's rare to be able to say, oh, this game is empirically good, empirically bad. Everything is subjective, right? But as close to empirical as you can get, you can have games that are strong foundationally, that aren't buggy, that perform well, like you talked about, Christian. And then this happens. Is this still a valid lens through which somebody needs to interpret this, whether that's the community team or or developers or leadership or, you know, someone in the studio
or individual buyers. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's the thing that is strange from my perspective, is just somebody looking at, if we're talking about these influencing purchasing decisions, which ostensibly that's their purpose, right? If you are uninformed about the state of Overwatch and you go and you look at that, you're not going to interpret a terrible, you know, overwhelmingly negative score as, oh, I guess people are making a real statement about the economics of how this game was internationally sold. You know, you would think, oh, I guess it's that gameplay layer that people are mad about. The game is terrible. And I think that's an interesting framing, because you don't have any mechanism on the site to contextualize that other than reading the individual reviews. But in this case, if you're talking an American perspective, most of these reviews aren't in a language that a lot of Americans speak, right? So it's further obfuscated, because you go, well, I'll just look at these negative reviews. Oh, can't read them. Or I guess I could run them through, you know, Google Translate. But it just, it feels like a confusion layer that's potentially problematic too. So it feels like a lose-lose on a number of levels for everybody.
I always pull out the, you know, would this make an interesting Harvard Business School case study? and I wonder if it would. I mean, especially when we talk about the importance, for this industry especially, the importance of China and the importance of serving that market in a way that not only complies with the government layer, which is very difficult to work with, but you've got a player base that at the end of the day, they're players just like us.
Yeah.
And if you were playing a game for 10 years on the same account, and suddenly the relationship between the original developer and the local partner that's absolutely required in order to get the game out falls apart, you're caught in the crossfire, as Christian identified, and you're a player. I've lost my characters. Yeah. I have lost my ability to continue playing World of Warcraft with my guild or my clan, right? So I understand the frustration.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's like it's not net easy at all.
Oh.
That was terrible. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
There's interesting stuff happening, and there's a game I certainly hope we talk about, but it's not going to be my story of the week. I'm not even going to say what it is, Jeff. I'm not going to pull you and mention something and say that that's not my story, but then talk about it for 10 minutes as I say that it's not my story, but then give all the details about it because it's still not my story. My story ties in a little bit to some recent paid DLC episodes we've had of our Wednesday show. And there's been some really fun conversations on those shows. Danish was on, I think, 2 weeks ago, and you all talked about it again. And the RP servers and role-playing, deep role-playing that's taking place in games that don't traditionally have it. And so if you haven't listened to that paid DLC from, I think it was 2 weeks ago, when Danish was on, he went through this really fun story of getting accepted into the server and the things he had to do in order to be a part of this community and how to play this game. And he was going to do the role-playing within Red Dead Redemption 2. And now, 2 weeks later, what's this news? Beep, 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 coming across the wire is Rockstar Games is acquiring the team behind 5M and Red M, and they are two of the larger RP mod communities and that run these files. Let me get this backing it up. That allow for that gameplay layer to happen. There are things you need to add to the game to do your and to make it work in that role play style community. And Rockstar is bringing these in house. And I think that is a super fascinating story. One, in terms of a recognition of how big these communities are and can be. I think perhaps the bigger issue is can be the potential that Rockstar sees in monetizing them the way they have GTA Online. And two, I'm fascinated by this continuing trend, Jeff, we've seen of fan-made communities being made legit or official with WoW Hardcore mode and now these role-playing servers. And I guess the question I would first offer to you, Mike, is this good? Yay, developer sees this awesome community stuff and wants to make it internal and bring it in-house. Or is this maybe bad in the sense of, oh, they're taking away our toys and going to monetize them and make them part of core product? Is one version better for the player than the other, or is it too early to know?
I think it's too early to know because it's case by case. I often love when people in the community do great things with a game that gets recognized and then they get paid for it. I think that is the virtuous cycle that we have seen throughout the life of this industry. You have people who come from the mod community. I mean, Patrick Soderlund, you know, early on, he was a modder. Yep. And then kind of that's how Battlefield was born.
It's Miss Pac-Man in the Waybacks, you know?
Yeah. So I actually love that when you have people who make fan games, which is a risky thing legally, depending on who it is that, you know, you're making a fan, what IP, who owns the IP. Like, don't do that for Nintendo, by the way. Never, ever do that for Nintendo. You're going to get shut down. The moment they find out about it, you're done. The likelihood of them hiring you is very, very low. But there are others where we see that it's like, hey, we've got a really strong mod community. Bethesda, you know, kind of did this as well with the Creation Club, and kind of some of those mods were built in house, but some of those mods were built by the community. And for this, I think it's really interesting. And I actually think this is very savvy of Rockstar because they see the importance of these communities. But, you know, you've got a note here about how, you know, there was a piracy concern, there was a banning that happened, and you know, Rockstar, the whole Pinkerton thing, like,
yeah,
companies sending Pinkertons to people's homes is a scary thing. But if they like the tools and they like the net result and they're worried about GTA 6 or the evolution of GTA Online, they want to include this, but they're afraid of how it's going to compromise the tech and potentially open the door to code injection or anything that could ruin the experience. And, you know, we've seen Bungie going after cheat makers very aggressively. This could save them a lot of money in legal costs. Mm. And at the same time, compensate the people who are doing really good work and serving their community, both of their communities, serving the Rockstar and the GTA Online community, but serving their own community of role players. I actually think this could be very, very cool. And if we start seeing those tools baked into official roleplay servers, and they're not going to compromise the experience, because I've played about half an hour of GTA Online and it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
I understand why they sell so many copies, because I guess people get banned left and right.
They got to buy a new one. Yeah. I think this is fascinating. You guys have said a lot of really, pertinent things that I just want to underscore. The first is that, you know, as Mike mentioned, it's so interesting because in 2015, which is 8 years ago, these guys were already doing this stuff, you know, and Rockstar's like, no, no, bad, bad modders. We don't like you to do this. Stop, cease, and desist. And now here, 2023, 8 years later, they're like, good modders. Thank you for doing this. Yeah. Welcome me into the fold. I think that's progress. I think that's really cool. And you love to see, you know, Christian was so right to point out the weird serendipity of this news. I immediately texted Lana and I both texted Danish right after this broke because we had just talked about it. It's so weird. This has been going on for a long time. And it just made my radar because our friend Danish was like, hey, I am doing this. A friend told me about how crazy the Red Dead Redemption 2 role-playing server is. And you have to, if you have a chance to, you know, financially, you can support the show at a level to hear the paid DLC program that we do for backers. It's wild to hear Danish describe the process. It's like applying to get a driver's license. It's you take a test. They give you, there's documents you have to study. You have to prove to these people that you are up to the challenge of playing on a role-playing server. It's not
easier
just like
to
oh,
get
I'll
a real gun. To go out and get a real gun than
no,
it is
no,
to
no.
get a gun in Red
Don't
Dead.
Don't even
2
joke. Don't even joke.
I'm not joking. It is yes, no joke there.
It's real. I think it's laudable how seriously they take it because this is not the people who want this kind of experience of really pretending like they live in the Old West, playing all sorts of different kinds of characters, having elaborate backstories, having entire world that's created where every NPC is a person, is a human being. Everybody you encounter is an actual human being who is taking this extremely seriously and is bought into the fiction. It is a remarkable thing to pull off to ensure that world is not going to be griefed or even just undermined from people just having, you know, a laugh. I think it's really cool. And the way in hearing Danish describing the process and how well thought through all of it is, clearly these developers, you know, these modders, have put in so much blood, sweat, and tears into this. There's a lot of effort and it's ongoing. It's not, they oversee all of it. It's managed. It's like, it is a, you know, what it sounds like a full-time job. It's like a lot of work. And to see that rewarded from Rockstar, I think is a pretty cool thing. I think if you would ask these folks, this is probably a dream come true. I mean, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but it reminds me of Narbacular Drop. Does anybody remember Narbacular Drop? That's the game that the DigiPen students made that became Portal because somebody at Valve was like, these kids are doing something really awesome. We should hire them and let them make something for us because they're using our, you know, source engine and making stuff on their own. I love when this kind of things happens. And that it was a real success story and a real inspiring thing, you know, way back when, whatever, 2005 or whatever that was, when you know, Portal became a thing. It was just these students, like, you know, doing modding basically. And that's what it reminded me of, because there's a lot we do not know about this. We do not know that these developers were brought in, these modders were brought in to make RP servers for anything. We don't know that this is part of GTA 6. We don't know anything about what the next step of this process is. And I suspect, again, this is pure speculation on my part, but it's my sense is that it could be as simple as, hey, these are awesome people making awesome stuff with our tools. We want them to be part of our company. Like we want their influence internal. And I think, because that's kind of what the Valve thing was. It's like, hey, there's these awesome kids doing this really cool thing with our tool set. Let's just bring them on and see what they make with resources, with real resources. And I think even if we don't see, you know, like an official RP servers that Rockstar is creating, I think just sort of bringing these folks on and having them influence the future of Rockstar games is cool, you know?
Absolutely. I have a couple ahead, stats Mike. For you real quick. Sorry. So Take-Two announced their Q1 earnings this week. GTA 5 is now up to 185 million units.
185 million. We just
185 million.
We did a story last week about how Konami was celebrating Metal Gear getting to 55 million
series-wide,
from 1987 on.
Yep,
and just one game. That's insanity. That's wild.
They also said that they're anticipating, quote, a significant inflection point in fiscal 2025. I think that's when we can expect GTA 6. So there's plenty of time.
Yeah.
For there's I would say that given Rockstar's history, I would expect a Q2 release or Q1 release rather a spring release for GTA 6. So that would be probably sometime between, you know, April or May of 2025.
Yeah, over 2024, but yes, 2025. Yeah,
2025.
Yeah.
Actually, no. If they're looking at it at fiscal 2025, it could be earlier than that. It could be March of 2025. Would make a lot of sense. So right at the end of their fiscal year. But here's the thing: with all those pre-orders, they're gonna you could release that game on March 31st.
Yeah,
and it would make their year.
Right. That's wild. Yeah, go ahead, Christian.
My only thoughts on it, or some other thoughts on it, I should say, are my concern about when you get a company's resources. And there's a great quote: while our day-to-day operations won't have any noticeable changes, with Rockstar support, we are going to continue to improve our platform, and we are truly excited for what this means for our users, community, and creators. That's a quote from the team. And I think that's the right quote, and hopefully the honest idea between both partners right now. My concern, and having gone through this on some teams over the years, is that when a big company starts giving resources, they start expecting return. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a business versus a passion. And people doing something because they love it and wanting to go out and do it is a very different thing than, we've given you $10 million. You are now a line item on our budget somewhere, and we need to see ROI, because it is an I. It is an investment. It's not a it's not a charitable gift. And so that,
I guess, unless you are selling $155 million units of something and you get money to burn, I don't know, maybe not.
That's literal money falling out of their pockets.
Yeah, exactly.
we bought this because we literally Brewstered millions our way through the day, and yeah, we couldn't spend anything else. And so my concern, unwarranted or unproven at the time, is that this is going to be something that needs to pay off for Rockstar, whether it is official RP servers or just integrating other ways to create deeper hooks into whatever GTA 6's online world or mode is, that then allows for Rockstar to monetize off of that. Because I think the scarier number, aside from Mike's already astronomical stat of how many copies GTA 5 has sold, is how much revenue GTA Online is making. And, you know, people, the bulk of those 185 million copies aren't people constantly replaying the story. It's also not people doing the Danish sign up for RP servers. A lot of folks are really invested in GTA Online, and it's a great package and a great way to get into that game. And so
let's be fair. I don't think the RP servers are moving the needle. You can only ever have 250 people online at a given time, and that. So
I agree. I don't think they're taking money from Rockstar, but I think what Rockstar sees is the potential to make more money by implementing some of those things in their broader release. And so I'm curious to see kind of how it shakes out when something becomes part of a larger company. Again, just to restate it, I think they expect something in return.
I don't. You know, clearly you're right as far as, you know, historically.
Wait, what was that? And
that's the cynical view that you're always so, you know, yeah, your cynical views tend to pan out. I will remain Pollyanna and say I hope that they do a RP official RP mode, just of how cool it sounds in the modding community, to have that be more front facing to end users and perhaps a you know, it entices more people to give it a shot. And I think it's just a cool thing. I've talked about in the show how I got into the hardcore servers on WoW and thought that was just a wild, interesting unique experience. And now that became an official server, official option. I think that it surfaces it to folks that might not know about these niche communities. And I think that's cool. I think interfacing with video games in new and interesting ways is awesome. It feels like a very emergent kind of way to play these games. And if Rockstar does embrace that officially and kind of puts that out as an official mode in their products, I think that could be really cool. And I hope, you know, I maybe it'll be just a way to crassly make more cash, but I also think maybe it could be cool for folks, you know?
I agree. I just don't trust a large company to then run it with the care that the community's been run. I think, as Mike mentioned, yeah. You jump into GTA Online, a lot of times that someone shows up with a rocket launcher and then, you know, griefs yeah. you for the next 20 hours. And I don't know. I don't know what that solve is. It's already something the Destiny community's been wrestling with for a long time of like, how do you bring new people in? How do you, and WoW as well, Jeff, I know you have like when people come in and how do you make a good experience for people?
Yeah.
And I think the more people you surface it to, the more, lulls are going to go along with it. But it's super interesting, and we have years to wait to find out.
yes, and kudos to that team. I think that's cool. This does seem to me like put in hard work, and sometimes people notice. I think that's neat. Well, you know, we're already long on the news segment, but we got to talk about my story of the week, which is a bunch of big games got new trailers. The THQ showcase happened this week. And we got a whole summer. Bunch.
We got more games.
Yeah. It's DLC. Barely summer. My kids are going back to school. And there's still new game announcements. All right. The list of the THQ showcase games is pretty awesome. There's some heavy hitters in here. There's a new South Park game called Snow Day that it looks like a departure from the previous role-playing game versions of South Park. This is going to be a co-op multiplayer action game where it looks like you can be able, you know, team up with friends and have a snow day and wreck all sorts of havoc. Unfortunately, most of the trailers in the THQ showcase were just CG kind of teaser trailers. Very few of them showed actual gameplay, but still really cool titles. I put so many hours into the original Titan Quest on Xbox 360, I believe. And Titan Quest 2 has been long, long announced, still coming. We got another CGI trailer for Titan Quest 2. I am absurdly excited for that game. I really hope they knock it out of the park. The Gothic remake got a trailer. Trine, the Trine franchise is up to 5. Mm-hmm. Nobody told me. I had no idea we are up to 5 Trine games. They had a very charming trailer that was all about hanging out with people and playing couch co-op in Trine. That's a series I very much love. Alone in the Dark, the classic horror franchise that's getting rebooted, remade, had two trailers that were some of the most striking, interesting, outside of the box ways to market a video game I've seen in a long time. It was just two of the characters. Each video only had one character in it standing. This is a fully digital character standing in a spotlight, giving a monologue that's sort of thematically consistent or, you know, in lore of what those characters are going through. Just really striking and interesting. Mike, anything else in the, anything else in the THQ showcase that struck your fancy?
I think, some of the trailers were really good, even if they were kind of cinematic. Outcast is the one that blew me away. I'm an old gamer, so I do remember the original Outcast in all of its janky glory. But this this game looks great. Like, I'm really excited for the new Outcast.
Yeah, third person sort of action open world looking. You're in the sky, you're doing stuff on the ground. And then they showed like this layer of hard to grok from just a trailer, but like interconnectivity of the world mm-hmm. that had sort of like a flow chart of all this stuff that was
like a relationship map or a mind map of something. Yeah, really interesting. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. That's called Outcast: A New Beginning. Christian, I'm sure you were excited about TMNT The Last Ronin. However, that trailer really didn't show anything.
That game trailer is way in the distance.
Yeah.
Yes. That trailer did not show anything. It had been rumored, now officially announced. I will say to people that are interested in it, the graphic novel is excellent, and don't internet search it. I think it's still excellent if you know
the thing,
what happens. But it is, I think, best read unknown. And so if you're interested in the video game and you want to explore that, just go pick up the graphic novel. You will enjoy it. It is an adult themed Ninja Turtle. So know that. And I'm curious, you know, they're pitching this as a God of War third person action game, adult orient. I mean, the story is adult oriented take. And I'm curious how well TMNT can straddle that or can walk on both sides of that line in other forms of entertainment. And comics have done a great job over the years, being the Nick cartoon friendly and also still having more adult fare and black and white and all sorts of stuff. But comics have kind of done that across books. You know, you can get Batman books that are very kid friendly, and then there's the Black Label books that have full frontal in them, you know, and are not kid friendly. And same with Spider-Man and several others. But in TV, movies, video games, the Turtles have pretty much been family friendly. And I'm curious how they can, how well this game will present them as, no, there's mature content out there. In fact, these characters started as mature content, and how that hits with the audience. But I'm very excited. But after this episode, my friends, I'm going to forget this game exists.
Yeah.
Until after GTA 6 comes out. When this game will then still be 2 years away.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool idea for a TMNT game. I'm excited about it. And it was very much a teaser. So we, you know, just literally candles being blown out. Mm-hmm. So, far off, but another game that, I didn't know about before this that, I thought was pretty charming is Space for Sale. Mm. This looks like a cute little, base building, exploring an alien world, top-down perspective, but just really lovely art direction. I thought it was kind of these chunky characters walking around on in a very pleasing environment. Sparked my interest as well. Overall, I thought this THQ showcase was a pretty strong collection of trailers, even if many of them didn't show much other than, you know, CG or titles. I just thought it looks like THQ has a pretty strong slate over the next however many cycles, you know?
Yeah, and I think they still have a ridiculous number of games that haven't been announced.
Yeah.
And that's across Embracer Group, which is going through its own challenges right now. But the one trailer in there that kind of stood out to me as being a little strange was the Gothic remake trailer, which wasn't really a trailer. It was like a gameplay segment, but it didn't really show much.
It was very odd. It sort of ended abruptly, and you know, there's like this kind of the guy goes into stealth mode and then is immediately found out, and he's like, hey, get out of there. And it's just very odd. But did you think that was gameplay or CG?
It wasn't clear. Yeah. It might have been in-game cutscene, so in-engine, yeah. Rather.
Yeah.
It was weird. Mm-hmm. And the Trine 5 one was cute, but it was also, I think people understand what co-op is. I don't think you need to do a whole trailer of like, this is how you sit on the couch and play co-op.
Yeah, the delivery guy comes in and they yank him inside and hand him a controller and you got to play with us. And it was kind of, yeah, cute, but very, you know.
I think a lot of people today might not know what couch co-op is. You know, not a lot of games.
Oh, that hurts.
I'm right there with you.
Anyway, some cool stuff to look forward to. I'm curious about the South Park game too, but man, Titan mm-hmm. Quest 2 for me is the one. If I could only have one, I loved that first game. It was so fun. All right, let's talk about the games we have been playing in a segment we call the playlist. Mike, what has been making your playlist lately?
Destiny 2, believe it or not. Yeah.
All right.
I got back into it. I played a little bit when it first came out. I put 300 to 400 hours in Destiny 1, just to be clear. I did not play much Destiny 2. When they first announced they were vaulting a bunch of content, a friend of ours took us through the Red War campaign, which was the original campaign. And we got through it and we're like, eh, okay, that's enough for now. And I got back into it. I've been meaning to. It was one of those things where I was looking for an excuse and found my excuse and have been playing it. And I've put 55 hours or something into it in the last couple months. And the season, the current season ends in a week, and I'm trying to get as much of the seasonal content done as possible now. That game, while its returning user experience is still challenged, once you are back in, and if you have somebody bring you back in and help you kind of get reacclimated, it's a very satisfying game, and I still don't know that there is another game that can match it in terms of gunplay. It just feels so good to play that game.
You know, I got back into it briefly around, what was it, the Witch King? Is that the least? Mm-hmm.
Lightfall.
Yes,
Lightfall's the current expansion.
I got into it when Lightfall came out. Bought Witch Queen. Queen.
Yeah, Sabathun.
It's yes, Witch Queen with Adam Lambert, so it's not the original Witch Queen anymore. But
Witch Queen? I haven't played any of that content, but I bought it. It was like $7. I was like, I'll buy this. I'll go back and play it. A friend and I were kind of getting into it. And then, you know, and then Diablo came along and other things came along. And now it's like Baldur's Gate and Starfield and a million other things. And I do want to get back to it because I was having a blast with it. It is, you're right. It is uniquely joyous in its simplicity. And it's, well, that's not simple. That's a bad way to say it. I mean, the pure game loop of it, mm-hmm. just the like the doing of the thing. And I guess that's applies to Diablo 4 for me as well. But
sure,
the doing of the thing is just they've just refined it to a point where, man, it just feels good to do that thing over and over and over again. Just blast those enemies, try a new gun, blast those enemies. So I'm very much a noob style gamer when it comes to Destiny 2. I don't know the systems in and out. I'm not trying to maximize my thing. I'm not trying to do, I'm just like in that game world having a good time. And that's enough for me.
And that's where I am too. I did have some friends take me through probably the most complicated raid that's out there right now, Last Wish. And that was 4 hours in one afternoon where we just hammered on this thing. And it was really, really interesting. But for the most part, because I'm focused on finishing out the season pass as much as possible, like I went from level 48 at the beginning of the weekend to 72, I think, when I finished. Like and so they do have a mix of single player content and multiplayer content. I'm not a Crucible player. I'm terrible at it. Mm. The only time I will go into the Crucible is if I need to do it for an exotic.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing. But it is systems on top of systems on top of systems on top of systems. And it is really difficult to pick that apart. And the thing for me that allowed me to get back into it was not focusing on any of the systems that I didn't understand or that weren't unlocked. And it was like, I am here to play through the story.
Right.
So I went back to Shadowkeep, which is the earliest available campaign right now, and just started playing that. Mm. And then, you know, as I was talking with other friends who have been playing, it's like, oh, in order for you to access this system, this is what you need to do. Like they added fishing in this season. And
you
in order to get
the fish with a laser rifle.
I would love that. However, you do get a fishing pole, but I didn't unlock it until yesterday. And like, I didn't know how to unlock it. I didn't understand how to interact with the seasonal content, like the seasonal story missions. So there are some places where I think because you have this game and that's gone through, hey, we had a publisher, we've split from our publisher, we're building up, you know, kind of our own internal competencies that a publisher used to provide for us. And at the same time, we have a game that is enormous, too enormous to maintain, so we have to vault a whole bunch of content. Mm. It created this whole situation where all of the systems that are there are very cool in and of themselves. It's the interplay between those systems that I'm guessing is the most complicated thing. And when you start to understand some of that, and by, as I said, I've played 55 hours and I just figured out how to access the seasonal content. And I was high enough level to access the seasonal content. So it is a weird thing. like, you can dive in and you can enjoy it. And there are times where I'm like, I'm going to go to the Cosmodrome. For those of you who play Destiny 1 will be very familiar with that. It's back. And just run bounties and patrols and public events and just work on my season pass.
Yeah.
And you can do that. And it just feels good. And I can, like, turn my brain off and shoot enemies.
Right.
And that feels great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what I've been doing is you said it much better than I did, as I clumsily said, oh, it's simple. It's not simple. It allows you to sort of ignore its complexities for much longer than other similarly complex games do. And that's kind of my feeling about it, is that there's so much of the game that I'm just ignoring because there's just fun stuff to do. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very big sandbox, and you can be very content sitting in one corner of it and engaging with only the things that are right around that. Whether that's bounties and patrols and story missions for the campaigns, if you're just diving back in. And that's my recommendation. If you're diving back in, just do the campaigns. And that will get you a feel that'll help you relearn all of the different planets and the different areas and the different, like, weird idiosyncrasies that exist in the game. And then you can start peeling back and looking at those systems.
Very cool. That's Destiny 2. What else is on your playlist?
Diablo 4. We're working through the season.
Yeah.
I got to get back to it. I'm behind.
You're
very behind.
Yeah, me too.
But I got to finish off Destiny season first, and then I can go back to Diablo.
So I would love for you to compare and contrast how those two very big IPs are doing their seasonal content. Because, you know, there's a lot of, I think, overlap. The Venn diagram overlaps a bit in this sort of battle pacification of things and how you... you know, you can go off and do interesting tasks and you'll be rewarded for those interesting tasks. But do you think one is doing things smarter than the other, or what's your take?
I think there are two very interesting differences. One is that because Destiny has all of those systems layered on top of one another, the battle pass is actually more meaningful. So there is a free and a paid track, as there is in most season passes or battle passes. And you get materials, and the materials have changed. Like, they've done a lot of tweaking, massaging. They'll introduce a concept and then they'll be like, okay, this doesn't work exactly the way we want it to, so we'll make it easier, streamline it, quality of life improvements, whatever. But throughout the season pass, the same seasonal weapon will show up a couple of times. And the idea here is you're going to increase in level between X and Y, and getting the new version, two things can happen. It'll either just replace it if you haven't invested anything into that weapon, because now there's this whole concept of masterworking, which is you can increase the pay, glimmer, which is the currency you get from killing enemies, and you can use materials to make a weapon better. But then you can infuse. If you've ever played a free-to-play game, like a gacha game, you know how this works. Like, you take something you don't want and you feed it to the thing that you do want, and it makes the thing that you do want better.
Right.
In this case, you can infuse a weapon with any other weapon, as long as it's higher light, and it'll bring it up to that level. Or you can take a weapon of the same type. So I have one of these guns that I masterworked, and I don't want to give that one up, but I got a new one that is a higher light level. You can just pay 1,000 glimmer. You can hold up to 250,000, just to give people who don't play the game a sense of how much it is. It's not a lot at all. And then it just brings it up to the level by feeding it the same type. And there's cosmetics in there as well, but a lot of it is very functional. In the Destiny Battle Pass, Diablo's Battle Pass is challenged because it's trying to be a more traditional cosmetic Battle Pass. But one of the things I'm finding is that they've made this tactical error where most Battle Passes, if you look at them throughout the season, if you do the entire 100 levels or whatever it is, you get enough currency to buy into the next Battle Pass to reward you. Or you can use it for additional cosmetics in the store. Diablo 4's Battle Pass is so weird that you don't even get enough of the hard currency to buy one cosmetic item in the store. Like, it's why is it even in the Battle Pass? It hasn't felt as meaningful to me. Now, I'm someone who loved Diablo 3's adventure mode, so I do love the approach to the Battle Pass. Mm-hmm. Like, being able to go and, like, pick activities that you're going to do to advance it. Is really enjoyable. But I don't think the rewards are clicking quite as much to drive people through, and it's not a great first impression. And if people bought one of the higher editions that comes with a premium unlock for the Battle Pass, where you get like the first 20 levels or something, I don't know that there's enough there to incentivize someone who did that to to purchase season two's battle pass unless they acknowledge and address all of the things that they might change along the way.
Interesting. Well, certainly the history is there for, you know, Diablo 3, for example, just mm-hmm. completely, you know, reworking itself to the point of getting to be really satisfying and popular.
Oh, so, yeah. I mean, Diablo 3 is one of the best turnaround stories
in
the industry. The other one being Final Fantasy 14.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, there you go. Interesting perspective on those two battle passes. I'm still trying to get back to my seasonal content with Diablo 4. There's just, ladies and gentlemen, there's just... All right. Christian Spicer, what is on your playlist this week?
So I'm going to start with the second game I thought I was going to talk about because I think it relates well to what Mike was talking about with Destiny and Diablo. And I've gone back to Forza Horizon 5 because they're doing their seasonal content. One, Forza Horizon 5, I don't really need an excuse to go back to it. I mean, there's a racing wheel somewhere there behind me. It doesn't take a lot to get me back into Forza Horizon 5. But they've introduced some new cars in this. The stuff that I was interested in has now ended. If you're listening to this, and you're like, ooh, I would like those also. They're not available anymore. But there was the seasonal content that had rewards of some cars I thought were cool that I wanted to add to my collection. And so I went back to Forza Horizon 5 strictly for the purpose of doing the seasonal content. And if you've listened to this show over the years, you probably know I'm not the biggest seasonal content battle pass person.
He lives in Los Angeles. There's no seasons.
There's no seasons. There's just not super hot, super hot, and fire. Like those are our three seasons, unfortunately. Bad air, you can't go outside. And then that one week that's real nice. And so I don't generally love battle passes or seasonal style gameplay. I don't think the reward is often enough to trick me into playing, if that makes sense. And I would love, maybe this is like a Wednesday conversation, or maybe we can peel off Mike some other time. This episode's already probably going to be long, but I love Mike's analysis, and I love the idea of battle passes and seasonal pass. And as he was just describing Diablo and Destiny, I think was fascinating. But I think there is perhaps a tipping point coming with this style of added content to games where you're doing a thing because you love the game, first and foremost. So you want to be able to spend more time in that world. But then developers are trying to give you a reason to spend more time in that world. But then that has to expire so that then you have to do it again. And so I have a lot of friends that are on that Fortnite treadmill. And you're like, yes, I unlocked whatever, you know, Ghost Spider. Awesome. And then the next season starts. And you're not going to play with Ghost Spider anymore because that was last season. Now you got to get, you know, whoever this person is. And so, and I think that's true with Destiny stuff as well. I've, you know, hundreds of hours in Destiny 2 at this point. I don't want to know the multiple of hundreds, but there's zeros there, right? And that grind of you get the thing and you masterwork. And I think that is a great addition to the game, but you get the thing that you want and then they nerf it or introduce something better or do the new raid that has a debuff for the thing that you have been using. And again, it's giving you reasons to stay in that world. If they just let you have the OP thing that you got at the end of the campaign, it wouldn't be rewarding because you would just be stomp, stomp, stomping around. But in Forza Horizon 5, to bring it back to that, my specific example, this past week and a half or whatever it was, I spent so much time playing the game doing things I didn't want to do in order to get the thing I wanted, that by the time I had the thing I wanted, I was kind of done with the game because it was like, you know, they make you
spoken Destiny, like somebody that doesn't play MMOs.
Maybe you know the reason why.
That's the MMO experience, baby. Do a whole bunch of stuff you don't want to be doing for the one glorious moment when you finally get the thing you wanted.
Again, I would love to do a longer conversation on this and on the psychology of that and how it works for a lot of folks. And then maybe just for me now, it's starting to rub me the wrong way where Destiny does this as well. I don't know Diablo's content, so I won't speak to that. But, you know, Destiny will make you do Crucible. And it's like, hey, you, and it's like, ah, oh, I guess I'll go lose for half an hour so that I can get the thing that I need to bring back to the person I need. And like Forza Horizon 5, I love it. I own the DLCs. I love Hot Wheels. I love Rally. I love all the stuff. But it's like, now I got to go do these drift events. And I don't want to get 3 stars at a drift checkpoint and such and such thing, but I need to because it's for the thing, because I want to do the thing, and the game's trying to show me all the stuff I can do.
Yeah, well, that's the counterpoint, is right. Like, it's fun for the I think it's fun for these battle pass style things to push you into areas that you might not go to yourself, and maybe you'll find that you do end up liking Adrift. Maybe not, but you know, there's. I think that's not a. I think that's a smart design decision. It's like, hey, let's push people into these all these different modes that are available. You know.
Yeah, I would disagree when I feel, unless it's new content that didn't exist in the base game. Like, if you're not into Crucible now, you won't be next season either, unless it's like something new that they're introducing. And like the drifting, it's not a new thing. It's just making me go spend time doing that again. And I think in a game, like a lot of these big games often are playgrounds that there's going to be parts that resonate more with people than other parts. And I think there's kind of that disconnect of making you, like you said, for MMOs, do things you don't want to do to get the thing. And so I love Forza Horizon 5, but I walked away from this season experience. I don't think I'm going to engage in it again because there's this like FOMO aspect of it that if you don't get it, then it's gone. But I'm not really having fun doing the thing. Like, I would have had more fun if I just fired up my 67 Shelby and just, you know, had fun playing the game. And I found it really fascinating. It was my first real engagement in that seasonal style grind in a long time. And I walked away remembering why I don't do it that often.
My concern with seasonal content is what I've fallen into with Destiny 2, because I was kind of behind. I started this season midway through and then I had to step away from it. Is that what I end up doing? It's the min-max thing. What is going to get me the most benefit towards the season pass content? So I haven't been going back and doing the campaigns. I've been doing gunsmith bounties. I've been doing planetary bounties. I've been doing patrols. I've been targeting those things. The thing that I love, Halo Infinite, Lego 2K Drive, Minecraft Dungeons, they have non-expiring battle passes.
Halo as well.
Yeah.
Or like no FOMO in it.
Yeah, it's no FOMO. Like, you can go back to it anytime. Hey, Minecraft Dungeons, I love. You got to buy them. They're kind of like, they're set up like traditional DLC SKUs in the store. And you have to buy them per platform if you're playing on multiple platforms, because it does have cloud saves. But you can swap between those seasons at any time and progress that content. Whenever you own it, you swap to it, you're progressing that track. And it's really great. And I'm seeing it only in games that are really youth-oriented. Again, yeah, with the exception of Halo Infinite. Lego 2K Drive and Minecraft Dungeons are very all ages. And I really appreciate that. But I would love to see more of that somehow in more games. And yeah, I understand why it's not, because we're talking live service games.
Right.
And the live service mentality is constant engagement. Most games want to be your forever game. Yep. Because they want to take up as much of your time as possible. And yeah, they're going to push you into stuff that you don't want to do, which is why I prefer, like, Destiny 2 is thankfully, like, I haven't had to do any Crucible. The Crucible I've chosen to do has been pursuing an exotic. Not because I've been trying to advance the season. There's enough there for single player that you can just do the single player and probably max out your season pass. But yeah, it's going to go away 8 days from now. That season is over. The new season begins. You have a full reset and you start the whole thing all over again.
But I think that's part of what people like about it, is like, I did the thing. I get to brandish my amazing, very unique, very limited edition knickknack, my hoobajube, my bright shiny hat, you know, and you didn't get it because you didn't do what I did. I think that's part of the allure for many folks, you know.
I agree. I think it's just a razor's edge. You know, yeah, you talked about Marvel Snap and those seasons being too fast and being on the other side of that edge for you personally, Jeff. And I think Forza kind of landed on totally that side as well. And when done well, yeah, I don't even realize I'm on that treadmill, but right, I feel like it's the another current example of everybody chasing a thing, and the numbers say that everybody can't do it well.
Yeah.
Well, and more than that, we're running out of time.
That's like the problem. Yes.
There are so many games that are going in this direction. We covered this. This was a few months ago. We called it the Gassacre. Games as a Service Massacre.
That's funny. I like it.
There was one week where like four or five higher profile, not highest profile, but higher profile live service games got shuttered.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see this happen more and more. And developers are getting less and less time to make their game successful. There was a Gundam game, an online game, that hasn't even hit its 1 year anniversary yet. Rumbleverse was another one that got yanked. Knockout City,
right,
which was originally an EA Originals game by Velen, former founders of Vicarious Visions, the Bala brothers. But yeah, we're seeing this whole thing where live service games are getting less and less time to make their mark. And yeah, okay, if a game is bad, like Babylon's Fall, that game's going to get yanked. But now we're seeing games that are landing, you know, review-wise in the middle, not hold on to an audience because you've got the titans in the industry,
right,
that are pulling all of the attention and the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Everybody wants to be your forever game, and I can't have that many forever games. I can't. Mm-hmm. I wish I could. You don't have forever as far as the timeline.
I mean, not when you've got single player games coming out that are going to eat your life, like, yes, Baldur's Gate, yes, and Starfield.
Yes.
Well, speaking of everybody trying to be your forever game, not Baldur's Gate. I'm not taking that transition. Jeff will take that one later. This is for a simpler time when games didn't want to be your forever game. I guess through multiplayer they wanted to be, but they were much simpler. As rumored and many
thought. They
didn't
know how. They wanted to, but they didn't know. It was awkward for everybody.
They wrote a note, but the friend didn't hand it across the desk. The teacher took it. As rumored and much thought would happen at this year's QuakeCon, Quake 2, the remastered version of Quake 2, was unleashed upon the world. And I've been playing a lot of Quake 2. I'm spending most of my time playing Quake 2 64, which is the Nintendo 64 version of Quake 2 that has now been released on PC, among all the other ways that you can get it, Game Pass and stuff like that. And it's been, beautified, not Resident Evil 4 Dead Space remake. This is very much a original Quake, but here's the in 4K style presentation that we're bringing to the table. And it is such a fast game, even today in the year of our game, 2023, to go back and be zooming around Quake 2. I am astonished at how fast it plays, and at times how much it demands of the player, where you're never resting. You know, you don't have a million things that you can do. I think even in Quake 2 64, you can't crouch. I don't remember this in the N64 version, but on playing it now in this remastered, you push crouch and you actually get dialogue on screen that says you can't crouch in Quake 2 64. And I'm like, got it. That's right. And so it's strafing, running, jumping and shooting, and then getting these upgraded guns. But what I find so fascinating about Quake 2 and revisiting it all these years later is this kind of first foray into connected worlds and zones with objectives and things you have to do, which is very different than Wolfenstein 3D, Doom, even Quake 1 in these early id games, or, you know, if you want a boomer shooter, the broad category of this style of game, where Quake 2 has you go and do things where you need to turn off the shield before you can get to this area. But you saw that area from this other area, and it's creating this world that is very different than Doom, which is just an arena, more or less. You know, get to the exit, get to the exit. Yeah, there's a story. Demons have unleashed. Get to the exit is all it is. And Quake 2 64, when it came out, added an actual narrative as well. I mean, again, it's not The Last of Us. I'm not talking, you know, you're going to be emotionally connected with these characters, but there's a story and a through line. And seeing that interplay with these connected worlds really hit home for me how much the first person shooter has continued to owe to id. I think a lot of times people focus on Wolfenstein and Doom, but they kept putting in that work over that first chunk of first-person shooters. And so I went back and looked. It came out in 1997, and here we are in 2023, arguably one of the greatest years for video games ever, or certainly for a long time. We're not through it yet, but with what's to come and what's already come. 1997 was Gran Turismo 1, Castlevania Symphony of the Night, Final Fantasy VII, Diablo 1, Dark Forces 2, Fallout 1, Star Fox 64, The Curse of Monkey Island. I think Virtua Fighter 3 might have also been 97. I mean, just this seminal year for gaming whose influence is still felt so strongly today, like just across those franchises. So many of them are still going strong. And I think if folks aren't olds like me and have not played Quake 2, graphically, it doesn't hold up, right? It looks old and polygonal, and you can shoot the heads off people, but it's kind of like two polygons fall to the side. You know, it's not like grotesque like it was before. But I think it's worth revisiting, one, for the speed of the game, which is in many first-person shooters these days, especially narrative campaign first-person shooters, is not the case with how fast it plays. And two, kind of seeing this beginning of what so many of the great first-person shooters do today in terms of creating this world that you, or shooters in general, third and first, that you live and experience and you have to do a thing to get to a thing. A really fascinating example. And I think it's a phenomenal re-release package, giving you all of the Quake 2, Quake 2 64, and new levels. Oh gosh, what are they called? They're like, it's like Machine Works, I think, is something like that. And it's like new worlds built in this engine, and it plays the same way. Truly an incredible, one-of-a-kind experience that I know people will swear by Quake 1 or Quake 2. I think push comes to shove, Quake 1 is maybe the better game. But I think Quake 2 is more interesting for how it tried to push a franchise and genre forward, and well worth the time as you sit here waiting for Starfield to come out and you take a break from Baldur's Gate 3.
it's also on Game Pass, right?
It is on Game Pass, yeah. Yes.
So check it out. All right. I clearly have been playing a lot of Baldur's Gate 3. I talked about it for 45 minutes last week. I don't need to belabor it. This week, everybody and their goat is playing Baldur's Gate 3, evidently, which is amazing to see. I just love to see how this, what feels like a labor of love, is hitting with folks. And it, you know, hit over 800,000 concurrence on Steam. It's just crushing. You know, Divinity Original Sin 2 like peaked at 93,000. People are just loving it. I think it's part of this Dungeons and Dragons essence that we've been experiencing over the last decade. There's a lot to be said about it. I think somebody should go into a deep dive on the fact that you can do early access on a AAA game, and look, it actually yields results. I think
they
that's
had a quote out saying they were afraid they had peaked,
yeah,
because of early access. They thought that everybody that wanted to play it had played it and they weren't sure how it was going to do at 1.0. And wow.
And, you know, a big single player experience that flies in the face of so much of the conventional wisdom in video gaming, that a lot of what we've been talking about, that you have to continue to monetize, there's got to be microtransactions, there's got to be all this stuff, but also that, like, people don't want turn-based combat, you know, which is a particular bugaboo for me because I love turn-based combat. And it just feels like everybody, you know, I was ranting about that with Final Fantasy 16, where it just feels like everybody just assumes that gamers across the spectrum of mainstream are kind of don't have the patience for anything turn-based anymore. And I think this just proves that is false, you know, because here's this game that is very methodical, very turn-based. You know, there's sequences that have nothing to do with combat that it makes you go into turn-based. It's just beautiful. Anyway, I could go on and on and on about Baldur's Gate, and I probably will for a few more weeks until Starfield comes out. So I won't belabor that too much this week. I want to tell you about my Jeff's Indie Game of the Week, which has really become Jeff's roguelite of the week, because I love roguelites. And I checked out a game called Tales and Tactics, which is, yes, a roguelite. But adding the roguelite layer onto an auto battler, which is not the type of game I've played a ton of, but I've always been intrigued by auto battlers. Of course, you set everything up, and then where you would normally have the tactics of, okay, I'm going to select a specific attack for that unit onto this guy. You know, think XCOM, but instead of you picking your attacks, you push a button and all the things you set up, all the dominoes that you set up for placement and selection of class and how everybody, you set the table and then you press a button and it all just happens. You watch it play out in real time in front of you. That's what this game is, Tales and Tactics. The entire skill here is in setting it up, is in placing the, selecting the correct units, empowering that collect units, creating synergies between units in such a way that you can defeat your opponent when you press play, and it plays out how all those attacks are going to go. And then you do these runs. It's a fun conceit, Tales and Tactics, in that it is very much the idea is that you are sitting at a table playing against a human being who's got miniatures and is sitting down to play this tactics game with you. So you're playing, but it's also like a fantasy setting. So you're playing against fantasy humans that have miniatures that are sitting down. I guess it's sort of like a Witcher Gwent kind of idea. But anyway, it's a fun conceit. The game has a kind of a sense of humor to it, which I like. And, you know, like the first person you fight is called like Newbie Bill or whatever. And it's like the descriptions of the characters are
very
fun.
Very Pokemon.
Like, oh, really?
Well, no, I mean, just when you like Junior Trainer Bill, know, it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. And the description, the flavor text will be like, hasn't quite figured out all the game systems yet, you know, like, or whatever. Like, it hasn't figured out that you should synergize your units. It's a fun intro into the game. But you're doing these runs where you're trying to go as far as you can, and you've got hearts as your life. If you lose a regular match, you lose two hearts, but every time you win a match, you gain a heart up to your maximum. And if you win a match at your maximum, you don't get any additionals. But so there's this push and pull of like, ooh, I lost a match, but I'm not out of things yet. I can still gain back and still get back to full health as I go. And I think all the systems are pretty slick in that, you know, you're it's actually aesthetically similar to Pokemon in that the creatures are very kind of adorable and bubbly and fun. They look a little bit like Pokemon creatures that you're collecting. And you get a assortment of them that you can choose from, and then you can pay currency, in-game currency, to re-roll at any point your assortment that you can select from. Every round you can re-roll for free, and you're placing characters on the board in specific locations. You're on a hex, you know, grid, and they have classes and types that will synergize with other classes. And so you have these statistics on the left-hand side of the screen that let you see like, oh, if I add this character onto the board, it's going to synergize with this and this, or maybe nothing or whatever. And so you're picking out how you can maximize your strengths, both in a creating variety of classes, which you need your DPS, and you need your tanks, and you need your healers, but also they have specific types like dragons or undead or whatever, and those will synergize with others and then unlock new special abilities when their mana procs, because their mana is just recharging at a constant rate, and when it procs, their special ability goes off. So it's all about figuring out, you know, like accelerating that process with certain power-ups and buffs, or synergizing certain ways so that when that happens, really big cool stuff happens. You can equip items onto characters. You can purchase multiple of the same character and then combine them to create like an uber leveled up version of that character. But all of it is in the setting it up process, right? It's all about placing all the dominoes and then pushing play and seeing how the dominoes go. And if it doesn't work out, trying a different strategy of doing that. I found it very enjoyable. And I liked the roguelite layer of it in that there's certain things that persist from run to run as far as, you know, increasing my power, increasing my options. But in the course of a run, I have all these cool systems that I can play with. And, you know, you don't have to sit there and watch it play out. You can fast forward and just see the result if you're impatient. But I enjoy watching my little creatures behave in certain ways and like, I didn't think he was going to do that, or that was exactly what I was planning or whatever.
Does it feel fair? If that's not quite the right word. Does it feel fair when you lose? Because I feel like that's for, like, you know, in Hades, it's like, oh, I clearly mistimed my whatever. And so therefore now I died and have to do it again. But I wondered in the auto battler format if it felt like rubber banding in some aspect of like, well, oh, the computer's cheating me.
That's an interesting question. I think that's an astute question and actually brings up something that I'm glad I was reminded to bring up, which is there are times when I felt like, oh, why is that unit just owning me? But it's got this really wild statistical layer that you can bring up that shows you like a minute or second to second graph of the efficiency of individual units, the efficiency of your team as a whole, where you got your damage from, why you got your damage from that area. It's got a really dense layer of statistical analysis that you can go into if you want to really, like, you lost a run and you're like, ah, or you lost just an individual fight and you go, ah, why? What happened at minute two or whatever that caused that? You can really dig in deep and it's got all that stuff there graphed out for you and
that's cool.
Highlighted. It's pretty neat. Yeah. And it's got a cute little story. So it does have the Tales side of Tales and Tactics as well. It's not just Tactics. I thought this was pretty charming little roguelite. It's just come out. It's called Tales and Tactics. And I enjoyed it. All right. You know what? I want to talk a little bit of tabletop time this week because we have a really interesting one that Mike's been playing. I want to hear about it. So let's jump in to tabletop time.
Right now.
That's right. Two tabletop times, back-to-back weeks. It's very rare these days, but here we are. I'm loving it. Mike, you have been playing a game that's very, I think would be interesting to folks that are playing a very popular video game at the moment.
Yeah, it's actually why I dragged it off the shelf and made the kids play with me last night.
Awesome. It's Betrayal at Baldur's Gate. I've talked at length about Betrayal Legacy on the show and Betrayal at House on the Hill. This is a version of that game set in Baldur's Gate, the same place that many folks are experiencing now in Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah, so if you have played or you are aware of Betrayal at House on the Hill now in its third edition, not including the Legacy version, then the gameplay is very similar. There are some differences. So for those who don't know, Betrayal at House on the Hill and Betrayal at Baldur's Gate, you start with no map. There's no board. There are tiles. And the starting rooms have doors. And the doors are either colored red for building, yellow for street, or blue if you're down in the catacombs. And there are ways to move between the catacombs and the upper level of Baldur's Gate. You walk through a door that doesn't have a room on the other side. Your movement ends. You pull the tile of the correct color and you place it and you do what the tile says. And that'll either be an instruction or it'll have an icon on it, which will be an item, an event, or an omen. And the omens, if you're familiar with Betrayal at House on the Hill, they work the same way, similar way. You roll a number of dice in this game. And the dice have blank sides, one pip or two pips. And if you hit six on the dice that you roll, the haunt begins. And that is where the traitor is revealed. And there are 50 haunts in this game, similar to Betrayal at House on the Hill. The one that we did, I'm going to spoil it. I'm very sorry. There are 49 others. I will not go into complete detail. This one was very different because the haunt kind of had two phases. There was no traitor revealed at the beginning of this haunt. The board was wiped. And we had to start all over again, building out the board until another haunt roll with four being the target instead of six. And then the traitors revealed. It was very, very interesting. A couple of things here. They gave it a very D&D flair. So each character and there are six, it's up to six players and they're color coded. And each of the tiles has two different versions of that or two different characters that are very similar. So I played the dwarf barbarian. There was a dwarf fighter on the other side. There's a bard and a ranger, I think, on the flip side of one of the other ones. Each character has a special ability, but all the item cards are things that you might expect, including a deck of many things or a potion of invisibility. All of the events are very fantasy themed. It very much felt like we were playing a fantasy dungeon crawl instead of the B-movie horror game that House on the Hill is.
That's awesome.
So if you are not a fan of horror games, even campy horror games, but you like the idea of a very easy to learn game. In fact, Betrayal at House on the Hill was my very first hobby board game that I ever played.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
It was my entry point into hobby board games. I recommend it. I especially with Baldur's Gate 3 out right now, if you want more of that and you don't have a tabletop RPG group and you can't do a campaign or even a one shot, but you really want that flair, I would recommend this game. And Lords of Waterdeep is another game that I would strongly recommend. Very, very different. It's a worker placement game, but again, very approachable, very easy to bring new players in. I would say this is one of the best games, but the Betrayal series in general is one of the best games if you're trying to get people who are non-hobby tabletop gamers to the table. You can't go wrong.
Totally agree, 100%. Well outlined. I think that is... a great description. I'm kind of the exact opposite for you. It took me a long time to finally play Betrayal at House on the Hill because I just wasn't drawn to the theme. You know, I'm like, spooky, scary. Okay, whatever. That's fine. But it's a phenomenal game. And I loved Betrayal Legacy. I've talked about it at length on the show. I've never had a chance to play Betrayal at Baldur's Gate. But now that I'm back into the Baldur's Gate world, I feel like it would be worth checking out, because it is wild when how the haunts always completely change up what you're doing, and it's so smartly designed, at least in the other two versions I've played of what it, how it changes things. And mm-hmm. You know, you're playing all as a co-op group trying to explore this area, and then all of a sudden one person is a traitor, and now you got an adversary, and it's just wonderfully designed. And I think adding that D&D flair would be so much fun.
Yeah. And again, you're loading up somebody with items, and suddenly those items are being used against you in the second half of the game. And it's like, ah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So it's got a lot of, like inside lore, like D&D lore stuff, right? It's got a lot of, you talked about Deck of Many Things and all that, but.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to have any familiarity with D&D to get something out of it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Very cool. That's Betrayal at Baldur's Gate. So if you're into Baldur's Gate, if you're loving the Baldur's Gate and you want more Baldur's Gate for folks to, sit around a table and be social with, this is a great, and honestly, completely second to the recommendation about Lords of Waterdeep, which is a wonderful intro into worker placement games. I have it sitting on the shelf right over there. I adore that game as well. Very, very cool.
Oh yeah, it's great. And there's a digital version. If you don't have people to play with and you want to learn how to play, digital versions are great ways to learn games, because you've got a tool there explaining the rules and letting you experiment.
Yeah.
In a way that you can't when someone's got to read the rule book and understand what's going on.
That's awesome. Well, I got a couple of board games I want to mention. My kids have gotten really into board games these last few weeks before school starts. I've been having a blast playing with them. My daughter and son both are completely obsessed with this game called Taco versus Burrito, which is a wild game. Evidently was designed by an 8-year-old. It's got a ton of take that. So your mileage may vary as to whether it causes fights in your household or not. Surprisingly, my kids just laugh when they, their sibling does something terrible to them in this game. But the idea is you have this little cardboard taco or burrito sitting in front of you, and you have a bunch of cards. Some are positive points, some are negative points, and some are special actions. You want to put the positive points in your own taco. You want to put the negative points in other people's taco. On your turn, you pull a card, play a card. You can play a card in front of you or in front of somebody else. And there's things where you can steal things from other people's tacos. You can force people to change hands with you. You can get your entire taco obliterated. And the fun is the flavor text, in this case, a pun as well, because it is, disgusting things to put in your taco. It is, week old sushi. It's the hair from a mustache. It's moldy bread. It's all this yucky stuff that you put in your taco or burrito. And then the health inspector can come and destroy things, and you can multiply your score with hot sauce, and it's cute. you know, it's definitely a kid's game. I don't think it is as it's something I would bring out with my own adult friends. It's got a lot to take that, but it's a cute game. The game I did buy specifically for my kids is an old Sid Sackson game called Can't Stop, which is a wonderful push your luck game, one of the sort of most pure push your luck games out there. And it's, I think, a really wonderful game to introduce to kids, specifically kids in my kids' age range, because it sort of promotes very basic arithmetic. You have a set of four dice, and you're going to roll those dice every turn and make pairs of those four dice. There's a stop sign-shaped board that you're trying to move up these pillars. There's all of the probabilities, all of the combinations of two dice that you can make. You might be familiar from a game of craps. Seven being the most probable, then six and eight, then what, four and nine. But, you know, how often the combinations will come up based on probability. That's how long, you know, the most probable combinations are the longest pathways. And you can start moving up those pathways. Each player has a colored set of tokens, and you try to move up those pathways. You want to get to the top of three columns to win the game, but you only are able to, on a turn, move up three columns at a time. So once you start rolling, you can roll as many times as you want on your turn, but you have to, once you start committed to going up a column, you have to keep rolling that combination in order to not lose. So you can lose all of the progress you've made on a turn. If, let's say, I'm starting with seven and maybe 12, I got boxcars, I got two sixes, and that's the shortest distance I have to go. So maybe I'm going to try to get boxcars. I got that seven and 12 and maybe eight. And I've been rolling, I'm rolling, I'm moving up, I'm feeling good, I can keep going. And if I stop, I'll keep all the progress I've made on that turn getting toward the top. But I can't stop because that's the title of the game. So I keep rolling. And one more time, I didn't roll a combination of dice that could make a seven, an eight, or a 12. And so I lost all my progress. And it's fun. My kids have had such a blast with it. We you know, my son's rolling dice and we're like, can't stop. Are you going to roll again? And it's fun because you're looking at all the different combinations. So you have to add all the different dice together and say all the different combinations that could be made from four dice. It's quick to play, super fun, great little arithmetic game, and very addictive. It's Can't Stop. One of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a great game.
All right. So there's some tabletop picks for you. And that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Mike Futter, it's always awesome to talk with you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me back. I love coming on.
It means a lot to me to hear that. Tell folks where they can keep up with you and all the cool stuff that you do online.
Oh, great. Yeah. So I would say first and foremost, the Virtual Economy Podcast. It's virtualeconcast.com. We're also on like every major podcasting platform. We call ourselves the podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We try to make these topics approachable so that if you're interested in games, you want to know more about kind of how the sausage is made, we try to be that door that you can walk through so that you can feel confident having those conversations.
It's a fantastic show. I really enjoy it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, we're on a bi-weekly cadence right now. Hopefully we're going to get back to weekly. We're in earnings season right now, so that always keeps things interesting. And obviously we've been talking a lot about Microsoft and Activision, which may actually wrap up on Monday of this week. There are some reports that the CMA might make its final determination this week, so that'll be really interesting.
Really hope the Country Music Awards comes through for everybody.
Yes, I really hope they do, because you know, otherwise Microsoft's dog is going to run off with its girlfriend or something.
Could you imagine that as a Gamescom announcement? We did it. Signed, sealed, delivered.
Could be.
I think if there was a way that they could keep that under wraps, they probably would. I totally, that would be hilarious though. You know, we're still on Twitter. I'm Footerish, FUTTERISH on Twitter and on Blue Sky. But we also have a Discord server. If you listen to the podcast, you know, if you like the podcast, reach out. You know, we'd love to have more people in our community. So that's probably the best way to find us.
Wonderful.
Find me and my partner.
Very cool. Christian Spicer, how about you? What do you got going on this week?
Well, this show is on Threads. You wait 9+ years to start a social media account for a show. It's DLC Hype Train on Threads. I'm also there. I don't use it tons, but you can find me there if you're so inclined, if you are embracing that new social media. It's Christian_Spicer. And for folks who don't know, and we're looking for an easy and convenient way to share this show with their friends, you can point them to dlcpod.com, and that'll take you to a nice web landing spot where you can subscribe to the RSS for this show and listen to episodes and stuff like that. And if you want to check out Danish's, I mean, I was fascinated. That 2 weeks ago paid DLC could have been twice as long. I know you guys had work to do and running up against the deadline. But
it was not me. I've been sitting around going, oh. This is all I do.
It was incredible. It was incredible. That's patreon.com/DLCpod for that episode. I don't know. Maybe at some point when Rockstar puts out GTA 6, we learn more about, we should put that episode out on the main feed a year from now, just so we can contrast like what it was to what Rockstar does. Yeah. And then ChristianSpicer.com is my website. If you want to go there.
Yeah, if you subscribe to the Patreon, you get all the back episodes of the Wednesday show, and there's some really, really fun stuff there. And also, you know, of course, you also get all that other cool stuff, including
Alex and I end every episode of Feeling This with follow that. You know, we really lay down. This last week's episode was about saving, which was kind of a little zig for what we normally talk about. But I kept hitting home for me, like it's how you end every play experience. Yeah. And so I want developers to spend more time thinking about that, because how my play experience ends might reflect on whether or not I want to engage in that game.
Yeah, for sure.
Again, yeah. Next time.
One of my biggest pet peeves, I haven't listened to the episodes, so I don't know if you guys talk about this. One of my biggest pet peeves is, you sure you want to quit? You haven't, all saved progress is gone. I literally just saved. Can the computer not be smart enough to tell me that I just saved and it's all okay to quit?
The only developers getting into heaven right now are the ones that actually put last save X number of seconds or minutes ago.
Come on.
I'm kidding. Everybody's getting in it.
That should be the norm.
That's best practices.
There's no universe where I need to be told that I'm going to lose all my saves if I just save. I'm talking to a computer. It should know that I just saved. Sorry. All right. Check it out. Also, you should check out my other shows. I have a movie and TV show review program called The Film Cast. You can find that wherever you get podcasts. I do a comedy science show called We Have Concerns. And I do a sports show called The Fan Controlled Show at Fan Controlled Sports and Entertainment. Lots of fun extra content. Check it out wherever you get podcasts. All right, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts. Hey, give us a suggestion. Mike, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I do. Star Trek Strange New Worlds. I have not watched the season finale yet, but season 2 just absolutely knocked it out of the park. Even with its weird tonal shifts back and forth, there was an episode about war crimes, and that was in between an episode that was a crossover with Lower Decks, which is an animated comedy show, which is still very Trek. It's still super Trek, and I love it. And then the episode after it was the musical episode, which was absolutely delightful as well. I think Star Trek Strange New Worlds is Star Trek at its best. And if you've ever had any affinity for the franchise, you owe it to yourself to watch. Now there's 2 full seasons on Paramount Plus.
Very cool. Star Trek Strange New Worlds on Paramount Plus. Christian Spicer, what about you? What's your parting gift?
Well, I'm saying this too late. People have already emailed us, but Virtua Fighter 3, Arcades 96, Home 98. That's why I thought it came out in 97. It didn't. 97, nothing happened. I
mean, 97 was the anticipation.
Right, yes, yeah. We were waiting. We were waiting with bated breath. 2 this week, but they are related. 1 is the Front Bottoms have a new album out. I've talked about them before on the show. I love the Front Bottoms. You Are Who You Hang Out With is the new album by the Front Bottoms. And then two, if you, like myself, are an Apple Music subscriber, Apple Music has launched a discovery station, which Spotify has kind of been known for better or worse, their discovery algorithm. Sometimes it can feel fantastic, and other times it feels like, you like Taylor Swift? Well, how about Taylor Swift? And you're like, yeah, I like Taylor Swift. Well, have you listened to this Taylor Swift song? Yeah, anyway. But Apple, for a long time, hadn't really had that discovery algorithm in terms of a playlist. You could go in and see albums it would recommend in the For You or new releases, and there'd be a new release, new music section where it would show you new music that is out that it thinks you might like. But this discovery station now on Apple Music, as I spend a lot of my parting gifts talking about new music for folks to check out, the intent behind its algorithm is music that it thinks you might like that you either haven't listened to, which I think is really cool. Like, you haven't heard this song ever, apparently, or the other fallback on it is it's not in your library. Mm. And it's not just new stuff. So it might be, you know, here's this old Thursday song and you've never heard it before, and it came out in a single in 2006 or something like that. So I think it's a really cool algorithmic approach that, if it works, could help make my parting gifts moot on 9/10 of these episodes, because people could get it from the Apple Music Discovery Station.
All right. Well, here's to making Christian moot. my parting gift,
just the parting gift, Jeff. Just the parting.
Oh, sorry, sorry, sorry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My parting gift is something I actually meant to bring up last week, and I totally forgot. Week before last, I had a birthday. Happy birthday! Thank you. I appreciate that.
Classic Jeff. Oh, you're making the birth month, are you? I forgot to mention. Did I mention? Did I tell you guys?
I had a birthday 4.5 weeks ago. It was August 1st, and I got a really cool birthday present that I just think is something I wanted to share on the show, because it was such an outside the box kind of thinking demonstrated by my wife that it really charmed me. So you may see it if you're watching the video version, if you're a patron watching the video version. Right there, I got the Lego typewriter. I've started a writing project. I'm really excited about it. And as a way of kind of encouraging that and supporting that, my wife got me the, it's very expensive, these fancy Lego sets for adults. You know,
awesome.
It's incredible. The typewriter is an extraordinary feat of Lego engineering, in that it is almost functional. It looks exactly like a typewriter. It has moving parts, and you can push a key and it'll move a, I don't even know what that thing is called, the thing that shoots the letters up on a typewriter. But even wilder than that, you can't see it when it's complete, but the innards, the insides of the typewriter, Lego typewriter, are accurate to the insides of an actual typewriter. Very cool. But that's not what made it an extraordinary gift. My wife unveiled the gift like that, completed, put together, constructed. And my initial reaction, like, she had it underneath, covered underneath some wrapping paper. I pulled it back, and it was the Lego typewriter fully assembled. And my initial reaction was, oh, I would have liked to build that, because that's the joy in Lego to me, is the building of it. But then she unveiled to me, that via some photos, that she and my son had built it together in secret over a series of like 6 sessions, where they would hide in my wife's closet, unbeknownst to me, and build it together. So in essence, what they were giving me as a gift was proof of a special connection that they got to have in my name. Because of me, they got to have this beautiful bonding moment. And I just thought, what an extraordinary gift that I have. My birthday created this beautiful moment between my wife and my son, or a series of moments.
That's really lovely.
Yeah. It dawned on me in such a, it was such a magical moment, because I literally, she pulled it back, and I think she saw in my face, I was like, oh, you built it. But then I realized like what they were giving me was this much more profound thing. And anyway, I thought I'd bring it up on the show as a suggestion. Like, what a cool thing to give to your loved one. I don't even know if it has to be Lego, but just the notion of, you know, if you have a loved one that you want to give something to, give them the gift of creating a beautiful moment for other people that he or she loves. I think it was very special to me, very special. All right, we also got a listener-suggested parting gift. This was sent to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It comes from Jacob, who writes, my parting gift is the wonderful improv shows that have risen from the ashes of college humor in the form of Dropout TV. There is the ever-changing tabletop show of Dimension 20, which changes up the theme every season from Candyland to fairy tales to inside someone's mind. Then there's my personal favorite, Game Changer, which is, as the name implies, a very different game show every episode where the contestants have to learn what they are playing as they play it. These include games that were so good, they got their own spinoffs in Make Some Noise, a very silly and creative improv prompt for points, Play It By Ear, musical improv, and Dirty Laundry, social deduction about someone's scandalous secret. It's available on Dropout TV or the College Humor YouTube channel as part of their channel membership for $5 a month. And if you can't afford the membership, their YouTube Shorts channel, Game Changer Shorts, has a lot of the show available as individual prompts. Thanks, and have a great day. Thank you, Jacob. Christian, I think you've talked about Dropout TV a few times. That's dropout.tv, I think, way to get it, but very cool. Thank you for sending in your parting gift, Jacob. If you'd like to be like Jacob, I'm sorry, go ahead, Christian.
I think we talked about Game Changer before, but Dropout TV is just such a fun name continuation for College Humor.
Yeah.
In terms of like, you know, anyway, it's a joke on a joke.
Yeah.
They make funny stuff. Yeah.
And then, you know, when that one fails, they'll be like Childhood Regrets. Or I don't know.
I think it's called Debt.
Massive Debt.tv. Anyway, if you'd like to have your parting gift read on our show, send it to us. dlcfeedback@gmail.com is where you send those. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Mike Futter and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those awesome bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can get swag for the show at dlcswag.com, which was created by Jesse J. Anderson. Our biggest thanks, however, go to our patrons for making the show possible. Thank you for supporting the show and making us able to continue making these. We really appreciate it. Our top tier patrons, our Hype Train level patrons, get their names read out at the end of every episode, which we're going to do right now.
Yick, we're starting with you today. That's right. Boom, already started. Yick, thank you for supporting this show. Zachary White, thank you for supporting the show. I know I've started a pattern. Am I going to say this every time? I'm not. But Nate, thank you for supporting the show. Jenny, Scott Hughes, Jimmy Radcliffe, Mitchell Ness, Jeff Luxack, Matt Bradley, Victor Valenzuela, Cheesy Bob, Hank Patton, Rob Rixman, Riley Knox, Kyle Starr, Michael S., thank you for supporting the show. Relentless Rex, Curtis from Louisville, comedian Aaron Trahan, Shoru Ken, Scott Lambert, Joe DeFrank, Stephen T. Seifert, Tyler Buckwild Brode, Dwayne T. Robinson, Rob Wonder Rob Dominguez, Kevin Eddy, Brian Jordan, Hyperboy 66, David Epp, thank you. For what? I mean, probably a lot of things, but here, this instance, supporting the show. John Sisko, Matt Valdez, Andy Joyce, Anthony Gulas, Dan Flanagan, Sasan, Adam Denby, Jonathan Talbert, Chris Zacharias, thank you for supporting the show. Chris Zacharias, Will with 1L Harris, Jonathan Putney, Mark Gowland, Malcolm King, Dan Palmino, thank you for supporting the show. Ben, Kevin Brazel, Stu Goss, Jonathan, Spiceman Forever, Schlepplifer. Thank you, baby, for supporting the show. Albert, for Hail to Dios. Spiceman Silencer, thank you for supporting the show. Mike Lombardo, Michael Buck, Peter Olberg, Jad, Christian Bravery, Octavian Ratziu, Jason Novak. Thank you all so much for supporting us and helping make this show possible. We wouldn't be here without you.
All right. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.